Welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 20th, 2001, and this is a recording of Richard Robum, who is talking on plant community ecology. The tape number is 2001-3.
Community ecology, and this is known in Europe as phytosociology. Phyto being Greek for plant, and sociology, I think everybody knows. But it's the way the plants arrange themselves, which other plants they choose to associate with, and why. But I'm going to start out with something by Dylan Thomas. It may not pertain to the topic very directly, but it's from a poem called Fern Hill. And it's an elegiac poem of his youth. I'll recite the first stanza. Now as I was young and easy under the apple boughs about the lilting house, and happy as the grass was green, the night above the dingle starry, time let me hail and climb, golden in the heydays of his eyes, and honored among wagons, I was prince of the apple towns, and once below a time I lordly had the trees and leaves trail with daisies and barley down the rivers of the windfall light. So, vegetation zones. Dylan Thomas referred to a cultivated landscape, but I'm going to talk about a natural landscape. And in this area, we find ourselves in more or less of a transition zone between the dry basin that lies to our east, which is dominated by sagebrush and bluebunch wheatgrass for the most part. Lots of other associates, things like arrowleaf balsam root, and many other plants that I could name, but better we should go look at them than for me to rattle off lists of species. As we move upslope from those arid basalt plains, we start to get a little more moisture, and we also start to get lower temperatures. So moving upslope, you get enough moisture to support the growth of trees. And the first trees that can grow in these areas that are really quite arid are ponderosa pines. And ponderosa pines have two things going for them. One, they are very stingy with water, and they can survive on far less than most other trees. And two, they're fire resistant. And in an arid area, typically, there are fires sweeping through periodically, both natural fires, which were common enough, but also fires that were set by the Indians that inhabited this area before the European or Euro-American colonization. There are whole ranges, the Blue Mountains, for example, where the Nez Perce used to live, in southeastern Washington, northeastern Oregon, where the dominant trees, ponderosa pines for the most part, were assisted in their dominance by periodic burning. The trees that would move in periodically and the dense growth in the understory was wiped out by fires that either were set by the Indians or at least not suppressed. And when the Forest Service came in and Smokey Bear became the icon of their brand of forest management, the ponderosa pine began to disappear. Excuse me. And Douglas fir came in. And other species of fir, and they actually have built up a huge residue
excuse me, a huge residue of dry and dead material. And when that burns, it creates a crown fire of such intensity that it will actually kill the ponderosa pine. So the forest that lives there now in the Blue Mountains is nothing like, that used to be in the Blue Mountains, is nothing like what we see today. But moving back into the ponderosa pine that grows on the eastern slope of the Cascades in Washington, as you move a little farther up, you get to transition into another zone, which is that's dominated by Douglas fir. Now, Douglas fir is all over. Ah, thank you. I guessed you would bring that, and I'm just walking out.
Deeply offended by coughing.
Ah, good. Well, this is great. This is a Holden 2001 cup. This year's model. So the Douglas fir, which on the west side of the mountains is a tree that is part of the progression toward what's known as a climax forest. That is, if you left things alone, who would win in the long run? Well, it wouldn't be Douglas fir, because Douglas fir will not grow in its own shade or in the shade of other trees. Seeds will germinate and saplings will begin to grow up, but at a certain point, they run out of steam because they're not as efficient in photosynthesizing with the low light levels that you find in a dense forest. So instead, what dominates on the west side of the Cascade Mountains are western red cedar, western hemlock. Those are shade-tolerant trees. And in the long run, maybe in the very long run, after the Douglas fir get mature and their efficiency begins to decline, they will die and be replaced by hemlock and cedar. On the east side of the mountains, it's too dry for hemlock and cedar. And Douglas fir can take more shade than ponderosa pine. So in fact, Douglas fir will come to dominate, and it will be at the final stage of succession. Plant communities are dynamic, and they're dynamic in space and in time. And what you see growing in a field one day is very likely going to be succeeded by something that is better adapted to the conditions that eventually become the norm. When a field is just bare soil, you have a lot of species that are known as ruderals, which comes from Latin for waste. They're weedy species, and they come into wasteland. I'm sure you're familiar with them. They're the kinds of things you see on roadsides. They're the kind of things that jump into your garden at the first opportunity if you leave a patch unhoed or unmulched. Dandelion is an example. Brome grass, cheatgrass is a notorious example in the dry lands of the West. It's an annual grass, which means that it germinates, grows, and produces seed, and then dies all in a single season. And it will invade an overgrazed grassland, for example, and its seed germinates early in the spring and very rapidly depletes the soil of what little water it held, and some of the later germinating native species then have nothing to grow on, and they become replaced by this brome grass. And the brome grass dries out, and then it creates constant fire every year in some places where brome grass dominates, the cheatgrass dominates. The whole bunch of species that are out there get burned back, which creates ideal conditions for more of the cheatgrass to come in. So that's an area that's in a condition of suspended infancy. It's going to stay that way
unless there's some way of restoring it back to the way things were. But what happens in a situation where human disturbance is not the norm, or physical disturbance is not the norm, as it is in a river valley, for example, you get the invasion of these opportunistic species, the weedy or ruderal species, and then they create new conditions. No longer is the soil bare, no longer is there a complete absence of shade, no longer is the temperature quite so high as it was before it was covered with plants. And in those conditions, new species are able to come in, and woody species would begin to colonize an area, shrubs, saplings, and they'll grow up. These would be the woody species that like the sun, and many of them would not be able to tolerate shade in the long run. Some things really can't tolerate the sun. There are many things that can't tolerate the shade. And so there's a process of succession, one thing after another, until you get what people used to call the climax forest, and many people still use that term. The climax community is the one that is not going to be succeeded by anything else in the absence of another disturbance. The reason people are discounting the use of that term climax is that, well, disturbance is a constant. If you look at things in a long enough time frame, you'll see a succession from one thing to another, or an oscillation back and forth from climax to subclimax, or from climax to primary or secondary succession. So, making our way up the mountain, we've gone above the Douglas fir zone, and now we're into this lower montane area. Montane comes from the word for mountain, and montane generally refers to the lower to mid slopes of the mountain. And in that area, you've got generally more moisture because you're closer to the snowpack. And as the snow melts, you get a lot of runoff the plants there are able to intercept before they hit the bottomland, which is liable to be much more arid. Also, the precipitation is a little bit higher on the mountain, which is still intercepting some of the moisture that's left over from the west side before you get down to the dry land. Are there any questions or comments at this point? I don't want to just stand up here and yak. It would be easy for me to do that. But is there anything you've been wondering about? Or anything that you've noted that you'd like to introduce? Yes?
I live around Yellowstone Park, and there used to be Atlantic aspen forests. What are the conditions under which, how do they fit into the slope?
Yeah. Well, aspens like it wet. You're not going to see aspens in a dry land area. You're going to see them in an arid land only along streams. Or in little seeps or sinks or meadows. They are generally a more or less disturbance-oriented species also. So you might see aspens springing up in an avalanche chute, which has both the disturbance and the moisture, more than likely, to sustain an aspen patch. Aspens are interesting ecologically because they propagate more by underground stems than they do from seed. So you look at an aspen grove, it could be hundreds or thousands of square feet in area, and it could actually all be from a single aspen tree. All of it is just one big organism. Lots of stems, but they are all united in a single root mass. In fact, there have been a friendly competition among people in different biological disciplines to claim the biggest organism on the planet. And there's a fungus which occupies a vast area in a forest in, I think it's Oregon,
And they can tell it's genetically identical. They poke down a fungus. The part of the fungus that you see, a mushroom or the fan of a woody fungus, is just a tiny part of the fungus body. Fungus body really is a network of thread-like branches that run through the soil, and it can cover a vast area. So they punch down, they bring up a little bit of this fungus, they analyze the DNA, they go to some other spot and pull it up, and they sample a huge area, and they find that it is genetically identical throughout. And then they calculate the weight of the fungus just by taking a known volume and figuring out how much that weighs once they get rid of everything else. They find out this is one huge organism. Bigger than a great blue whale. Same thing with aspens. So whether the aspen or this kind of fungus is the biggest thing on Earth, I think is still in dispute. That's sort of a long answer to a short question. I'll move on and make our way up a little higher into the area that we've got around here. I have after kind of a late start, started to figure out what all the conifers are around here. And there's quite a diversity. And I'm sure once I start taking some hikes up higher, I'm going to see different ones as well. But what we've got down here, we've got western red cedar. That's a moisture-loving tree, and that's one that's very common on the west side of the mountains, but not so common over here. And the reason we still see it here is that we are in a transition zone between that wet side on the west and the very dry side on the east. It's a very steep gradient between the wet and the dry. In fact, there are some areas where you can draw a line no more than 80 miles from a point where you get 180 inches of rain per year to one where you get 12 to 15 inches of rain per year. So that's a difference of maybe 15 times. There are few places on the planet that have a moisture gradient like that. And that means you're going to see a whole lot of different types of species in a relatively short transect. So what else have we got blooming around here, or growing around here? There are two kinds of fir, at least. I have found subalpine fir and Pacific silver fir. Subalpine fir has a narrower profile, and it has sort of brushier leaves. The needles tend to stick up more than those of the Pacific silver fir. The Pacific silver fir has a distinct whitish or silvery bark that is more or less smooth. And it tends to grow in the montane areas lower down. The subalpine fir, as you might guess, is going to grow right up to tree line. We've got Douglas fir here. Douglas fir, which you can find all the way from the Pacific coast to the Rocky Mountains. I've seen lots of Douglas fir growing together with lodgepole pine in western Montana. And so it extends right into the Rockies. But we've got it here. It's another species that it has sort of broad ecological amplitude, as we say. It covers a wide swath in North America. The other conifers are Engelmann spruce. Most of the spruce on the West Coast, some of the biggest trees in the world, are Sitka spruce. But they tend to grow within the influence of marine climate, and that influence is pretty well faded by the time we get here. Of course, all of the water and the storms come from the Pacific Ocean. They're intercepted by the mountains here, but Sitka spruce is actually going to have more of the cooling and more of the moisture. It's a wet area plant. Engelmann spruce, on the other hand, grows
both in boggy places and where it's drier. And we see a lot of Engelmann spruce around here. It's definitely a west side plant. East side of the mountains plant. How many people are here are from the Pacific Northwest? And from where else have you come? I know you're from Minnesota. Any other states represented?
Idaho.
Okay. Well, that I'll call that Pacific Northwest. So we're Minnesotans and Pacific Northwesterners. I actually lived in Minnesota when I was a toddler. My father was born in Twin Cities. My mother in Sand Creek, Wisconsin. The one outstanding thing we have in common is, well, two. Latitude, although we're farther north here, believe it or not. And glaciation. But there's quite a contrast between the species that live here. Yes?
I'm a Connecticut Yankee by birth.
Uh-huh. Well, once again, you've had the glacial influence, but you're even farther south than the rest of us. And the eastern deciduous forest is quite a different animal. Much more domination of deciduous trees. I don't need to tell you, toward the east. And it's probably a good time to expand on that point. Why do we have conifers, evergreen conifers, dominating in this area? It has to do with the big difference between the climate from the Mississippi Valley east and the climate from the Rocky Mountains west. Summertime is when moist areas generally get most of their moisture, or at least it's even throughout the year. But in the western portion of North America, summertime is when the least rain falls. So you have to have trees that are not only adapted to huge amounts of snowfall and rain during the winter, but also can make it through an extremely droughty summer. We get 75% of our rainfall in western Washington anyway, between October and March. And in the months of July and August, total rainfall for the 2 months together might be about 3 inches. So it's very scant precipitation for these huge trees to survive on. And the reason they can is that they pretty much can shut down during the summertime when they need to. They close their pores. All plants need to breathe while they're photosynthesizing because they have to take in carbon dioxide through their pores, and they let out oxygen. If oxygen builds up too much, it starts to actually get in the way of photosynthesis. That can happen in a cornfield or a soybean field just as much as it can happen in a forest. But they often will just shut down. If it's just too dry, rather than kill themselves from thirst, they'll stop photosynthesizing. Well, that's okay for an evergreen tree, but if you're a deciduous tree, if you shut down during the summertime, when are you going to photosynthesize? Not after you drop your leaves. That's why you end up with a dominance of these evergreen, needle-leaved evergreen coniferous species on the west. And they grow to prodigious heights. In fact, their mass probably helps them get through the drought because in a tree that size, the overwhelming majority of its bulk consists of dead wood. And it's just a thin layer on the outside, just under the bark, that is the living part of the tree, plus its needles. And they don't drop their needles. They don't have to remake those leaves every single year. So they conserve the nutrients as well. And nutrients are most available, again, during the summertime, when the biological activity in the soil, all of the microbes and the small animals, nematodes, springtails,
all kinds of goodies living in that soil that help to break down the organic material and make it available to trees when it dissolves in the water and is taken up in the roots. So that's not really so much a digression. That's more on topic than I usually am. But we're making our way up into the upper montane zone, where you see a dominance of some of the trees that have made their way downslope to this point. The subalpine fir, which we see growing around here, and it's not rare, and the Engelmann spruce. They're quite common here. As you go higher, they're going to be dominant. You're not going to see any more Douglas fir, certainly not going to see western red cedar. You're not going to see the Pacific silver fir. All of those things are going to drop out because they just are not well adapted to both the heavy snowpack and the colder temperatures that you find higher up on the mountain. You know, just the shape of that subalpine fir tells you that it's prepared to shed snow. The other thing that I hope we'll see going up the mountain is mountain hemlock, which is a beautiful tree. And of course, it is related to the lowland hemlock, the western hemlock that we see down below. But it is also well adapted to those conditions up higher. So this whole zonation, and we're in a transitional area where we see things from downslope coming up and from upslope coming down, is a product of that, the physical factors, and also of the competition between species. If you wiped out the Engelmann spruce and the subalpine fir here, you might well see it dominated by Douglas fir. But the niche that they really want to occupy is going to be down below. I'm going to do a little thing. Grow.
How does the lodgepole fit in that? It looks like there's some lodgepole on the way up there.
Yeah, I saw lodgepole just down the road that way. Lodgepole is another species with very broad amplitude. Shore pine actually is the same thing as lodgepole. It grows differently, but it can interbreed with the lodgepole that you see in the mountains of Montana. It's the same species. You will see different ecotypes, and the form of the lodgepole pine that you see along the shores of the Pacific Ocean, you know, say down in Oregon, you'll see the upper beaches dominated by shore pine. It's the same species as these tall-growing, very dense forests of lodgepole pine up in the montane areas of Montana. So lodgepole can grow where it has the opportunity, where the competition is not greater. It's very well adapted to disturbance because it has what's called serotonous cones. The cones are glued together by resin, and only at a certain temperature, as when a fire sweeps through, will that resin melt and release the seeds. So a lodgepole pine forest may burn quickly, and they produce a lot of fuel, and they are not very long-lived, and they're not very big trees. But as soon as it burns, immediately all the seeds that are released by the fire are going to germinate. And so it's got a self-perpetuating mechanism. So we could see lodgepole up higher, and we could see it farther down below. Lodgepole isn't going to go into the subalpine zone. At that point, the pine you'll see is white bark pine, and not much else in the pine genus. So just a little bit on niches. You could say that a certain species, you know, it has its own bell curve. this might be a species with broad amplitude, and you might have another one that goes like this. And this would be a species with narrow amplitude. Does this graph make sense to you? That is, under certain conditions, we could call it elevation, or we could call it moisture, whatever we want to put on this line. You know, the wetter it gets, up to a certain point, you know, this is just going to be too darn wet for this thing. You're not going to see much of it, and here it's going to be too dry. You could call it temperature, same thing, but let's put all those factors together. And so you've got one species here that occupies, it could occupy this entire area. In fact, in competition with other species that might be better adapted to some of these other conditions, where it's competing with this one, it's not going to do so well. So actually, we're going to erase this part, because you're just not going to find it there while the other species is competing for the same resources and doing a much better job of it. So you have a potential niche. Which is the line before I erase part of it. And then you have the realized niche. And the realized niche, say it's also going to lose out on this side to species number 3. The realized niche would just be between here and here. So that you're not going to find it in these other places, even though it has the potential to occupy them. Our agricultural crops are an example of something that have a realized niche that is determined by artificial conditions that we create for them. The truth is, most of our agricultural species don't run rampant over the planet because we have bred them and selected them to survive under conditions of tender, loving care. You know, you just don't come across a whole lot of corn plants in an abandoned parking lot. You know, they can't survive. They're really wimpy species because they survive on massive doses of nitrogen that we feed them. We weed them. You know, we aerate the soil. We water them. We do everything we can to make life beautiful for those corn species. And what we end up with is this lovely ear of corn that is great for us to eat, but is a terrible way for a plant to try to propagate its seed or spread its seed. You know, the ear of corn, you know, is going to fall on the ground. It's probably going to rot. You might happen to get a bird who swallows the seed whole, if it's, you know, a strange bird, and might expel it farther down the line. And the seed might germinate, but in general, these artificially selected species that we use aren't going to do that. The niche we create for them is the only niche that they're going to occupy very well. And that's because we, not nature, has selected them for particular conditions for our own purposes and not for the corn's. Anyway, that's probably enough yak. I do have some slides. I also want to encourage comments and observations.
I just want to pursue that a little bit. There's someone in Kansas, Wes Jackson, who's doing experiments with perennial grasses, hoping to replace domesticated wheat varieties with that. And I don't know how successful that experiment is. I think he's made some progress. If you did that in the Northwest, is it more or less possible, or is there any way to reverse the domestication with and go back to something like perennial or native food sources?
It could be done. That economically, it doesn't make any sense.
the reason we selected these things over the last 12,000 years or so is that we found that we got a lot more bang for our buck.
Right.
You know, the amount of time and effort that goes into producing the nutrients that we use, you know, the starch and the protein that we get from plants, you know, the better we got at it, the more time we had for other things, the more surplus wealth we had to, you know, to create our culture. And so if we go back to the hunter-gatherer situation, it's just going to be a much leaner existence. And for some people, that's, you know, that's a virtue they'd like to pursue, I guess. But I don't think it's going to work for most of the planet.
Well, the argument is that what we're doing isn't sustainable in terms of soil loss or other kinds of conditions.
No cultivation required, right?
Yeah, and the petroleum inputs into you know, industrialized agriculture is. And so, is there a way to invent a new kind of combination of compromise?
Yeah, well, I think you can strike a balance between the worst abuses of industrial farming and, say, the most extreme form of gathering whatever the native plants produce. I don't think either one is viable in the long run. I think organic farming offers an option there. Organic farmers are using species that were bred, selected. They may not be buying from the big seed companies. You know, they may be preserving heirloom seeds, even, that the farmers of the 19th century used, you know, where the organic farming was all there was. But still, these are the size of the grain. You know, their nutrient needs are greater. You know, whether you use manure or ammonium phosphate to fertilize them, you've got to give them more nutrient than they're ever going to get in nature. And you also are producing these big, fat, juicy fruits that the critters are just going to chow down on unless you do something to control the critters too. You know, organic farmers have to control pests one way or another. You know, they don't use it with diazinon, do it with diazinon, but they do it with something. Because you just have hordes of insects coming to lunch at that table. And why wouldn't they?
I think part of the rationale of this perennial approach is that also you'd have more than, it wouldn't be a single species, there'd be like two or three or four different grains or species in the field. And it wouldn't blend itself into this, there'd be more of a balanced population of insects there. And so you would probably have less than your insecticide.
Yeah, well, I think there are a lot of smarter approaches to farming that could be employed. There's a natural economic impetus for the manufacturers of chemicals or seeds to promote their own solutions. You know, what's that?
The Starlink Roundup Ready corn.
Right. My jury is still out on genetically modified organisms. I agree with the National Academy of Sciences that we need to look at the product of genetic engineering rather than the process of genetic engineering itself. I don't think that genetic engineering is inherently evil. There are a lot of people using insulin derived from genetic engineering that would agree with me. But I do think that we need to discuss this a lot more than we have up to now, because it suddenly, you know, there it was. There wasn't any debate or discussion. It was just, you know, it was brought to a stage of perfection that made it commercially viable. And, you know, Monsanto and, you know, various other corporations introduced these things. And, you know, farmers in this country took them up, you know, because it worked.
you can't argue with success unless you've got some pretty good arguments. And, you know, simply having misgivings or it gives you the whim-whams, you know, it's not going to, you know, make a farmer who has a hard enough time making ends meet. You know, a huge number of farmers now are just part-time. You know, they drive trucks for part of the year, and then they work the farm the rest because they can't compete. You know, the market doesn't really work in their favor, and, you know, here's something, it's another tool, it seems to be working for the guy next door, so why not? Yes?
What do the organic farmers use to keep from presenting delicious foods to the insects?
Well, sometimes they plant species that will repel bugs. Tobacco plants might be interplanted with, I don't know, I'm not much of a horticulturist or agronomist, but part of it is using species that have natural insect repellents in them, as tobacco does. Part of it, they use netting. They don't put too much of one thing in one place, as you mentioned. They'll go in and physically pick off bugs. It's a more labor-intensive process. There's no question about that.
More natural predators.
Right. Yeah, and they'll use bio controls. A lot of them use BT. Bacillus thuringiensis is a bacterium that will paralyze the guts of caterpillars and moths and butterflies and their larvae. They consider that a more natural solution than applying a chlorinated hydrocarbon neurotoxin. Did you have something you
wanted to... This is coming back to out here in our sort of surrounding area. We noticed just hiking over to 10 Mile Falls there, the number of ferns in the area. Is that quite prevalent in certain areas of the mountains? More so, say, up at tree line or down below, or how do they fit in? I mean, it seems to be, they seem to be quite prevalent right around here.
Yeah. Well, ferns in general prefer moisture and they do well in shade. There are fern species that live in the dry sun, but ferns cannot reproduce without having water for their sperm cells to swim through. They actually have motile sperm. It swims through the water until it reaches an egg cell of a fern. Now, that's different from the spores that you see. The spores can, travel great distances. They get carried up into the Gulf Stream. They'll fly over the ocean, and ferns are some of the first things to colonize volcanic islands, things that rise up, like the island of Surtsey came up off Iceland a few decades ago. Ferns are some of the early colonizers. They just fly on those jet stream winds. But ferns have two separate life stages, and one of them is the part you see, which has the spores. The other is just a little vegetative growth that produces the egg and the sperm cells. And if they don't have water, they don't go anywhere. So generally, ferns are going to be in the moister areas, the lusher areas. Something that's really ferny, you're going to expect to be damp and sometimes even water dripping. What we've got around here, bracken fern is very common. It's one of the most widespread plants on the planet. And I've seen a lot of bracken here. And it's a dry area fern. Also has an edible rhizome, the underground stems that Indians would make flour out of. And sometimes they would burn areas to propagate, encourage the growth of the bracken. Other ferns around here, I've seen a woodland fern, or spreading oak fern, and maidenhair, a lady fern, which is more of a lush moist area fern. I haven't seen sword fern around here all the time. Your question? I've just rambled on a lot about ferns. Maybe there's an answer there.
Some prevalent, I think, you know, we have a number of them back in Minnesota. Our area not being up in the moisture areas, we've got some right on our own hillside and so on.
I know you'll have be cinnamon fern, holly fern, male fern, and of course bracken is everywhere. I remember seeing a lot of bracken at Devil's Lake, Wisconsin. Any other questions or comments? I've got some slides, which we have a few minutes. I can run through them. There's some pretty pictures, it also gives you kind of a close-up look at an ecosystem of grassland in western Washington, which is not the norm. As I said, the tall trees, the conifers, are the things that have come to dominate this area. And we don't have much in western Washington in the area of native grasses. Where there are areas dominated by native grasses, they commonly are wetlands or mountain meadows. Almost all the fields you see, ball fields, lawns, or even just a weedy abandoned area, or an old farm that has been retaken by nature, the grasses out there are all non-native. They're European and Eurasian pasture grasses. But we do have areas dominated by Idaho fescue, which doesn't grow only in Idaho. Twang my magic thumper. Anybody remember the Andy Devine show? Twang your magic thumper, Froggy. Okay. Well, these are the areas of our native prairies in Washington. The Black Hills is a basalt formation, and it was resistant to the glacier. The glacier actually split into two lobes as it came south. And this is the very south end of Puget Sound. Here's Fort Lewis. And I had prairies, I had research plots out here in Weir Prairie. So we've got a lot of these native grassland areas, and the reason they exist there is primarily this two things. One is glacial soil. This was the southern end of the Puget Lobe of the Vashon Stade of the Fraser Glaciation. It was one of those pulses of ice, and it's the last one that we know of, and it ended maybe 12,000 years ago. Melted back up to Canada. And there may be another pulse on the way. We don't know. We tend to see things in relatively short time frames. So we may still be in the Ice Age, and there may be another pulse on its way. We don't know. There's some geologists I know that say, geological time is divided up. Everybody's familiar with Jurassic. Well, that was a geologic period that was named for
I think a place in Yugoslavia called Europe. But once you get into modern time, what they call the Quaternary, or the fourth period, you've got Pleistocene, which is the time of the glaciers, and back to 2 million years ago, and the present time, which is the Holocene, which started maybe 15,000 years ago or 12,000 years ago. And some geologists say, oh, why call it the Holocene? You know, for all we know, we're still in the Pleistocene. So this is very droughty soil. This is, you can see gravelly, it's sandy. I'm sure you've all walked a rocky riverbed. You know what that's like. Lots of cobble, gravel, and sand. And that's exactly what this was. This was just the river of ice became a river of water, and it was carrying huge amounts of debris that it was pulling down from Canada and grinding up. And then it all got washed and tumbled. And so these rocks are smooth and rounded as if from a river. You dig into a glacial till where they weren't part of that outwash, and you'll find they're much more angular and sharp. But these obviously have been through the river, and they form deposits maybe 100 feet deep. Well, when you've got 100 feet of gravel, you've got a well-drained field. Most people, when they put in French drains, don't dig down 100 feet to do it. And these strange mound formations were created out of the tail end of this glacier, the terminus. These are all on outwash soils. And how they formed is still a mystery. Geologists have been cudgeling their brains about this for, since about 1838, when Lieutenant Charles Wilkes, you heard of Wilkes Land in Antarctica? Well, Lieutenant Charles Wilkes was commissioned to do an exploratory voyage, and he went around to Antarctica, he went to Hawaii, he also went to the western U.S., and he was the first one to record these mounds, and he actually set some of his soldiers to work excavating them because he thought they were Indian burial mounds. But they came up with nothing. There's nothing inside them. And they're just too vast. You know, these would be some really hard-working and kind of nutty Indians to spend all their time building these mounds. It would have been a labor that would have had to occur more time than they had after the ice went away. So it's a mystery. Oh, by the way, this is bracken fern. It's out of focus. But the top of this mound has a lot of bracken fern growing on it. And it's probably a southern exposure, so it would be drier. The other side of that mound probably doesn't have a bracken fern on it. What you see in the background, these are like soldiers marching onto the mounds. They're Douglas fir trees, and down here is a weedy invasive species, Scots broom. It's in the legume family, so it's got bacteria in root nodules that will help it to take nitrogen from the atmosphere and turn it into nitrogen that the shrub can use, which is a big advantage over species that can't do that in a nitrogen-poor area. Anyway, here they come. This is a fire on the artillery range at Fort Lewis. I had research plots on the range. I had to consult with range control every time I went out there. And they were actually lobbing shells into that area where the fire's coming from while I was out there making my measurements of the plants. 155 millimeter howitzers. But these fires were important for keeping those trees that were in the last shot out of the prairies. And as soon as they started to suppress those fires, you can see fire on the left side and grassland on the right. As soon as they started to suppress those fires, those trees began to invade the Douglas firs. This is Idaho fescue. Just looks like a kind of a skinny grass to you, but looks like romance to me. And this is a sedge that grows out on the prairie. This is a long stolen sedge or Pennsylvania sedge, and it grows right together in a matrix with the Douglas fir. This is prairie June grass. This is something that goes out into the Great Plains area. Same species. And this is California oak grass and a spider. I'm going to have to run through these quickly so we don't miss our meal. This is something called biscuit root, which is pollinated by flies. Early in the season, when it's maybe a little too cold still for the bees, it's the same genus that as other plants are called biscuit root. This one is called spring gold, but it's got a big starchy root. In the carrot or parsley family, and the Indians would use this, dig it up, get carbohydrate from it. Starch. It's the prairie violet. You know, let me see if I can turn off another set of lights. It's a lot better. Well, that helps. Oh, that. Well, do you recognize this plant? Some of you must grow it. Some of you must
eat it.
Yeah, exactly. This is a prairie strawberry. And this is a buttercup. This is the western buttercup. Fuzzy leaves. This is something... in the saxifrage family, if you know the plant, there are a number of them, foam flower, youth on age, or piggyback plant, they're all in the same family as this one. And a lot of these grow up in the mountains as cushion plants. This is another in the same family. This is prairie star. It's one of my favorite prairie plants. And this thing also grows all the way into the Great Plains area. Maybe a different species, but very similar. This is chocolate lily, also known as rice root or fritillaria. See the brown and yellow spotted flower. It's in the lily family. And the reason it's called rice root is that just like tulips will put off little bulblets. This one puts off offshoots, and they dangle around the main bulb like little grains of rice, and it's also edible. In fact, it's got very good sweet carbohydrate or sweet starch in it, and you just cook it briefly, and it's quite tasty. Of course, you know, when I see a chocolate lily, I don't think of digging it up. This is its capsule. It's in fruit in this picture. This is shooting star. This is another spring flowering prairie plant. And of course, shooting star also extends east. And I got one upside down. Well, I had to get at least one upside down. This is in the iris family. And this is called Cicerinthium or... blue-eyed grass. There it is, right side up. This is the fruits. It's good if you're collecting seed, as I did, in order to help propagate these things and help restore prairies, to be able to recognize these things in fruit. This is the balsam root. There's a species of balsam root that grows east of the mountains, but this one is specific to the west side of the Cascades. It goes down into Oregon and up into British Columbia, but always on the west side of the mountains. Prairie blue violet or early blue violet. Camas.
Tamas is, well, I've been going on for an hour, so you're welcome. If you need to cut out, go ahead. I'll run through the rest of the slides for those who don't need to. Tamas is an important source of starch for the Native Americans, and another reason that they would burn the prairies. Tamas, unlike the chocolate lily that I showed before, takes a long time before the carbohydrate in it breaks down into a form that can be assimilated by the human gut. And so they would dig a fire pit and throw these bulbs in and cover them with moist leaves and put hot rocks in it and let it cook for a couple of days. And then finally the camas root would be edible. But it was very important as a means of exchange. Indians from the west side with lots of camas might meet Indians from the east side with lots of biscuit root at Cascade Pass, which is just up from Stehekin, in exchange so that they had some variety in their diets. This is one of three different lupin species that were out on the prairies at Fort Lewis. This is the white-stemmed lupin. This is an annual, the bicolored lupin, a very small, delicate, and attractive little lupin flower. And this is the prairie lupin. This is the delphinium, which is toxic. This is death camas, which if you're not a good shepherd, you put your flock out in an area where the death camas hasn't yet died away. It dies away the same way lilies or tulips do. After May, you don't know where your tulips are anymore. Same thing with this. But a good shepherd is going to make sure that that's gone before the sheep come out. This is just more of the same interspersed with the Idaho fescue, which is very bluish looking. This is harebell or bluebell. And you see this all over the planet. Dogbane, kind of a peppermint-colored flower. Woolly sunflower, this is later in the year. Blanket flower, more of a blanket flower. This is an aster that grows out on the prairies. And this is not a dandelion. It's And the next slide will prove it, because this is the thing in fruit. And it's very oriented toward the sun. The flower doesn't open unless the sun is shining. The necks are hung over until the sun comes out, and then they stand up and open. This is an orchid. This is known as ladies' tresses. And there's another orchid. This is a different species of the biscuit root. In this case, I think it's being pollinated by a wasp that sort of looks like a fly. And these are the fruits. These seeds are full of oil, aromatic oil. If you've used coriander seeds, or caraway seeds, you know how fragrant they are. That's because they're full of oil, and they have oil tubes here. And I'm not sure if they're an insect repellent meant to preserve the seed, or if they're somehow meant to attract pollinators. This is one of the rare species of butterfly that is out on the prairie. It's called a bulge checker spot. Porcupine came barreling out of the artillery impact zone while they were lobbing those shells into it. He's out of his element. Porcupines eat the bark off trees and didn't want to be there. The
These are the savannah sparrows. And you can see what an effect a little bit of a shadow has on them. It triggers a response. As soon as I move my finger over, even though their eyes aren't open, they sense light and dark, and they open their mouths up. There is a bluebird, and they put special boxes for them all over Fort Lewis to encourage them. And I think that's enough. We're at 7 minutes to 12.
All right.
And thank you for your attentiveness.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's going to be another hike today, leaving at 1 o'clock from the kiosk. We're going to go to 10 Mile Creek and back.
I was just reading yesterday about the tobacco. The tobacco plant generates a chemical, like you're saying, that tends to inhibit growth of insects.
Yeah.
But that it also generates a chemical. And my understanding was into the air that then spreads to nearby plants and also helps them. To prepare for the same pest that's in the area.
Yeah, that's they know about it from tobacco because they've done research on tobacco, but it's probably true of a lot of other plants that these chemical signals allow for communication from one plant to the next. And so the first one to be munched by an insect will start to produce the stuff,
right.
And then the others will get the signal, and they'll all do it because it doesn't pay. There's an energy cost to producing whatever this metabolite is, and so they wait until they need it. But yeah, that's been found in other species too.
Yeah, right. That was fascinating. Talking about the. Some of the medicinal uses of plants and how plants have quite elaborate defense systems, which makes sense.
Yeah, there's an awful lot going on that we don't have any inkling of.
Well, how about larch? We're up at Copper Basin, I saw quite a bit of larch.
That's subalpine larch.
Uh-huh.
Larix lyallii, if you like to hear the name. Yeah, and it's really a sight to see in the fall. I figured, as you get higher, larch is going to be in the higher areas. How far up were you?
We were right up in the basin, so it was about, I think it's about 5,600, something like that.
Yeah, when did you go there?
That was, I think it was last Friday.
And what was the snow like on the way?
Very little snow. There were two patches kind of along an avalanche chute that was, it was like 15 or 20 feet across that we had to go across and get some water underneath. So, those two spots.
That's kind of cool. How secure did you feel across the
avalanche? Well, I felt pretty secure. Also, it wasn't very deep. It wasn't very deep. It was nearby, up and down the way.
I just want to be sure that if anybody is inexperienced or not sure they're putting in.
Right. Well, you could still, I guess you could go up to that point and always head back.
Yeah.
See about a few days of the difference.
Yeah, well, if you were there last Friday and it wasn't any big thing to do, then, it's almost a week later.
Right.
And sunny, warm,
or even, yeah.
Yeah, but there's quite a bit of sun since then.
Yeah.
Probably just melting down from that.
Good. So my name is Richard. You're
Mark Burley.
Nice to meet you, Mark. And you're from?
I'm from Toppenish.
Ah.
It's over right in the dry side of only that semi-arid region.
Right. Okay. Well, I guess if you didn't correct me, I must not say anything too wrong.
I'll see you over there, actually.